what's your largest concern? Representative Bigham has to get someplace really fast. So we can do her bill first, which is actually also dealing with veterans and military affairs. And then we're going to military affairs to turn to a budget presentation. And then, of course, we're going to the, again, because we have someone who needs to get out of town, critically is going to go to 1440 to pay equity bill, because someone's out of town and wants to speak on that. So so if people are here for things coming on later, if you just tell us where you are, you don't have to sit through the whole thing. Okay, Representative.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd like to move House File 1523 for as amended for possible inclusion in the state government omnibus bill.
Okay, now this is the one.
Chair, I don't have any information here. Can you wait until I at least get billed?
Well, it was amended in capital investment. I have a copy of an amendment, but I mean, I don't know what happened. But it was amended, and basically what the amendment says is that it's going to go to... It basically moves it instead of bonding to cash. To
okay. Well, we'll copy the amendment and pass it out to people while we talk about it.
Okay. I'm going to be real brief because we had a pretty thorough discussion in capital investment. Here with me is Don Driggins. He's a member of the board and a supporter of the Minnesota Disabled Vets Camp, which is located on Big Marine Lake in Washington County. He could talk a little bit about the history, but basically this is asking for an appropriation of $1 million to upgrade and expand the camp that currently exists now to serve a new generation of veterans as well as the veterans that have resided there since World War One or have used it since World War One. The one thing that this could be used for is a reunion to help a reunion place for families to reintegrate back into civilian life. So I'll have some closing remarks about some other organizations that are very supportive in donating their time and money to this. But I'll let Don Driggins talk about the vets camp.
Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Don Driggins, D-R-I-G-A-N-S. The original farmhouse was donated and converted into a dormitory rooming house for shell-shock victims of World War One. World War II shell shock was called battle fatigue. Today it's called post-traumatic stress disorder. The camp's main function did not change, only the name of the disabled veteran's affliction. The word camp in our name means to a veteran something different. To a military person, it means a place of security, safety, rest, and a place where he and his friends that are going through the same thoughts and dreams that he has. We had a Marine veteran up there that every time he heard a helicopter come flying over, he would go into his camper and hide. Towards the end of the year, he would sit outside. He'd watch it, but he would sit outside with his friends. When they say it's over, it's not over. The horrors of war are always there. With 3,000 Minnesota National Guard soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan in the near future, and the reintegration of these soldiers, the use of our programs and services provided to them has increased. There are many challenges they must face and master and accomplish. A few being replacing the stresses of war with peace, relaxing, mind-cleansing thoughts, and move beyond war and finding meaning of life and coming to peace with God, themselves, and others. The others in the soldiers' lives can our family, friends, fellow workers can number in the thousands. this appropriation will double the services that we'll be able to provide with to these veterans and disabled veterans. There are 420,000 veterans in the state of Minnesota, and approximately 70,000 of those have a disability. There's a saying, if you went to war and weren't changed, you were crazy before you left. And it really holds true. Are there any questions of me?
First of all, we figured out what happened was that the bill, capital investment, even though they amended it, they just laid it over. So there was never another engrossment, and there was never any notice to us that there was a...
They adopted the amendment, Madam Chair.
Yeah, I know.
Oh.
But we never...
Okay.
But it never left with me.
Oh,
that's why.
Well, we can blame Representative Hausman.
No, I'm trying to explain why something happened. So the basic issue is, have you seen a budget for this and for how the money is going to be used?
Well, we're waiting for the county engineer to come and talk about it. I have the list of what it will go for. Just real quick for the committee, Mr. Driggin's comments are in the form of a letter, and they were distributed out to members. The other organizations that I was talking about that have agreed to donate time and money very generously are the bricklayers, a lot of trade unions, electricians, pipe fitters, plumbers, carpenters, equipment operators, and also Anderson Window will either donate windows or the form of a grant money. But the county engineer just walked in and he has to get back to a board meeting, and so I can have him talk about the improvements and the expansion of which this $1 million one time, and it's also in the letter, but the one time appropriation, and he can talk about the upgrades and expansion.
The question that I have is, could we phase this in? Could we give part of $1 million and still get something meaningful done? That's the question. Remember, if you turn to the back page of the letter, there's a description of what.
Yeah, good morning, Chair. My name is Don Tyson. I'm the Washington County Engineer. To answer your question, Madam Chair, is yes. We would be able to make use of any money that you appropriated and phase in the improvements.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I could run through the improvements also. What you're going to have is a handout sent around that has two maps. One is titled Big Marine Park Reserve, and this shows the boundaries of the county park that wraps around the Veterans Rest Camp. The Veterans Rest Camp is approximately 70 acres in size. The Big Marine Park Reserve is 1,850 acres. The other map that you see is the proposed plan for Disabled Veterans Rest Camp. This is directly out of the plan unit development document that Don and the veterans prepared and lays out the improvements that would be funded with the $1 million request today. So to answer your question of how we would phase those in, we certainly could look at what the phasing plan would be, but an example of some of the things that the $1 million would fund are a new lodge building with a gathering space for 150 folks, meeting rooms, offices, a kitchen, a canteen, three outdoor pavilions for the Veterans of Foreign War, the American Legion, and Disabled American Veterans, new modern duplex cabins, and single unit modern cabins. The key here is these are disabled veterans coming back, and so fully accessible cabins are really something that's helpful. Certainly disabled veterans don't have the ability, as much ability for setting up tents and campers and such. Looking at new and improved tent sets, though, for those types of veterans that do prefer that. New boat slips on Big Marine Lake, new fishing dock, swim beach improvements, and even just as important, certainly want the veterans there to have safe conditions, so a new well, septic system, so it's a sanitary site also for the camp and all the extra campers there.
Okay. Are there any questions from members? represented in anything. Just to represent the big represented housing and not including this and to combine it a little.
No. Thanks for bringing that up, Representative. No, you're making a good point. No, she did not. As you know, that this is a smaller. They don't have as much money for bonding this year or capital investments this year. Next year is the bigger capital investments. But just because we're having a lot of our contingency come back in July, hopefully, that I just feel that is better to do it this year. They can get started and have the improvements starting this year. They have a great plan. This is bipartisanly supported, and it's moving in the Senate as well. It's in Senator Vickerman's omnibus bill there for veterans. I'm hoping that at least if we can keep it moving in both sides, that we'll get some sort of an agreement for money, whether it's a phase-in like Representative Kahn is saying, or the whole appropriation of $1 million.
You know, my thought is, again, since we are dealing with the funding bill next year, we just give something, if we give something that will stress this up, then maybe it can be in the bigger funding bill next year. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bingham, our testifier. Can you tell me, I see in the letter that you sent out, there's a number of community events that happen at the camp as well. What kind of a percent does the community use the camp or access the camp?
Representative Ward, Madam Chair. The camp has many of the military organizations come up, the American Legion, the VFW, the Paralyzed Vets. We also have the veterans' homes, both Hastings and Minneapolis, come up 3-4 times a year. We have a large pontoon. It's about 12 or 14 by 30 that we take out veterans and also we have one group that is sponsored by the American Legion in St. Paul Park, along with the Lions and the DAV, where we have approximately last year we had 50 mentally challenged and handicapped children come up. They have a fishing contest. There's a lot of the organizations have their social get-togethers there, and we have quite a few people that utilize the camp.
Okay, thanks. I think Representative Bingham, now you'd like to move that this be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Yeah.
And we'll come up with some number that fits.
Thank you, appreciate it. Thank you, members.
We'll move the amendment with it.
Yeah, as amended.
Yeah. Okay. We're now going to Department of Military Affairs to finish their budget presentation. Okay, who's ever starting? Just say who you are.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Colonel Joe Kelly. I am the Assistant Adjutant General for the Joint Staff of the Minnesota National Guard. And with me to my left is Mr. Terry Palmer, the Comptroller for the Department of Military Affairs. Madam Chair, I'd like to start by expressing on behalf of my boss, the Adjutant General, Major General Larry Shelto, his regrets for not being here today. He was called away to an out-of-state meeting. You have a packet, a brief packet of slides. The agenda for our presentation this morning is for the benefit of the new members of the committee is to give a very brief overview, and for those who returning members, a refresher of the Minnesota National Guard, Department of Military Affairs, and then Mr. Palmer will get into the specifics of our budget proposal. On the second slide, it's entitled Why the Guard is Different. And as you may know, the military forces of the United States, particularly the Army and the Air Force, are made up of three components: an active duty component, a Federal Reserve component, and a National Guard component. Members of all three of those components, when they enlist or are appointed, swear an oath of office to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. Only members of that National Guard component swear a second oath. They raise their right hand and swear an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the state in which they reside. And of course, in our case, that's the great state of Minnesota. It's that second oath and that dual componency that gives the governor of each state direct access to the military forces of his state, the members and the equipment and other resources of the Army and Air National Guard. And it also gives us our dual mission. We have a federal mission to provide trained and ready soldiers and airmen to fight and win America's wars and conduct operations other than war. And we also have a state mission to be a trained and ready emergency response force in case the governor calls us. The third slide is just simply a recap of this, to give you an idea of the size and scope of the Minnesota National Guard. There are currently over 13,000 of your fellow Minnesota citizens serving in the Minnesota Army and Air National Guard. We gratefully thank you for your support over the past number of years. We have been able to have a period of continuous personnel growth, and we thank you for your support. We continue to be amazed and humbled by the number of young men and women who step forward and serve, and those who continue to stay in our ranks during some pretty challenging times. The next slide talks in some detail, just quickly a recap of how often the governor calls out the National Guard for emergencies. As you can see, over the past 3 or 4 years, it averages over 1,000 man days, if you will, soldier person days per year that the National Guard is used to respond to fires, floods, lost persons, and so forth. We also have to have the ability, though, as we saw in 1997 and the floods of 2003, to surge well beyond that level of capability. And in today's world, it's not difficult to imagine emergencies that would require a larger response by the National Guard. It would be an understatement on the next slide where it says federal mission. It would be an understatement to say that your National Guard has been very busy over the past 5 or 6 years with our federal mission. If you look in the bottom right-hand corner, you see we have deployed nearly 13,000 soldiers and airmen since 9/11. And a couple slides back, I told you there were 13,000 soldiers and airmen in the National Guard. So we've been very busy. Many of our soldiers, most of them have deployed, some of them multiple times, and I know you're all very well aware of that from the newspapers and the news. We've been in the Balkans, Bosnia and Kosovo. We've been Southwest Asia, Afghanistan, Iraq, and many other places around the world. Unfortunately, as we look forward, while we think the numbers of our participation will come down from where they are today, because today we are very fully employed right now with over 3,000 of our fellow service members in Iraq right now with the 1st Brigade Combat Team. As we look to the foreseeable future, the departments of the Army and Air Force have missions for us. So we will continue to send our soldiers and airmen overseas in support of our federal mission. The next slide, where it talks about the communities impacted, talked about the soldiers from the 1st of the 34th Brigade Combat Team in Iraq. That unit alone, the soldiers from that unit come from 585 communities across the country, across the state of Minnesota. So it's difficult to go any place in this state and find someone who has not been affected by the deployment of that one large unit alone. That dispersion across the state also gives us a significant challenge, because we have to take care of families, and we have to take care of soldiers when they return. It's a far easier proposition to have a brigade come off of a fort, Fort Carson, Colorado, where they're all located in one geographic place, where all the services are there, the hospitals are there, the family support counselors, all those things are concentrated in what in effect is a town. It is a big challenge for us to be spread all across the state of Minnesota. Are there any questions about, from an overview perspective, and what your National Guard is and what we've been doing over the last number of years? If not, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to our Comptroller, Terry Palmer.
Madam Chair, committee members,
Terry Palmer, the comptroller for the department. The final slide, I think you have in the package, shows the governor's budget recommendation for the Department of Military Affairs. The total of our request is just over $41 million. And that's in general fund money. If in the total budget book, you'll see that there are more funds coming into the agency. About 68% of the budget that goes through the state side is federal money. About 30% is general fund, and 2% is other funds from local governments or from other state agencies. We have about 257 state employees on our complement, but only 31 of those are 100% state funded. All the others are supported in some fashion through federal funding, either 100% or at some reduced amount, based on what their particular mission is. In our budget book, and in the slide here, you'll see our first program is the maintenance of training facilities. This is the request this year is for the biennium is $11.18 million. About $10.95 million of that is for Army maintenance. And this appropriation provides funding for the operation and maintenance of the 63 Armory facilities located around the state. It also provides for the state match we're required for federal funding for the Air Guard bases and for the logistical facilities located at Camp Ripley and around the state. The change item, the recommendation from the governor, is for a $3.5 million increase in funding. And as part of the budget solution of fiscal year 2003, we had to lay off our entire complement of general maintenance workers located around the state, and we thought we could accomplish taking care of the buildings with the staff, the federal staff that were located in the buildings, and through help from the soldiers there. But as we found out, there are some significant challenges. One is the staff is really there to take care of soldiers, and they're not doing that if they're washing latrines and taking care of sweeping floors. And the other part is the soldiers are there to be trained, and they can't do that if we have them busy doing other things. And one of the other challenges we've discovered is you have to have operator licenses for the boilers. So we have to have some consistent staffing at these facilities to provide for that service. Otherwise, we are in violation of state statute taking care of the boilers.
Palmer, could you pull out in the number what that number is? Suppose we were to say we weren't going to fund all of this, but we were going to fund part of it, and that's a major part, obviously, is the boiler part. And suppose we were to look at, some funding to fill in the rest of us. Could you give us what the amount that would be needed for that?
Madam Chair, committee members, that's a little difficult to do. I would say the solution we've given you that the governor's recommended is really an 80% solution. We've taken the square footage of all our facilities and applied the civilian equivalencies required to take care of those buildings, and that's where we come up with that cost and the number of employees to do that. The problem we anticipate having is our normal business model would have a sharing custodians across facilities, but we're not going to be able to do that in some of the outstate locations because the distances between the buildings are too great. In the metro area, where the distances are short, the facilities are heavily used because that's where the larger units are. So we have some challenges in trying to provide that level of funding required, a level of manning required to do that. But we would anticipate this would be about 42 full and part-time employees plus contracting services at this level. But again, it's only an 80% solution for taking care of the buildings. We also have significant challenges in the summer because of the forest protection requirements for our buildings. There's often a great setback from the roadways, which means you have some lawn or grounds that have to be maintained. And then in the wintertime, of course, the facilities require snow plowing or removal of snow from the sidewalks, and we're really tasking soldiers and federal staff to do that right now. It's not working well. We also have a one-time request for special assessments. The business model for construction of armories in the state of Minnesota is a little unique. We ask that the local communities donate property to us and also help pay for the cost of construction of the armories. And because we own the property, the state of Minnesota owns the property, we also get some special assessments against that property, and we have no money to pay those special assessments. So as required by state statute, we've included that in our budget request. That's $185,000, a one-time money. Our second program is the general support program. It's essentially the administrative budget for the department. That's just over $3.5 million. That's the TAG and his staff, the adjutant general and his staff, and all the connectivity costs for IT and all those other things that agencies have. We also pay the lease for the Veterans Service Building out of that appropriation. The first change you'll see in there is an addition of three employees to the complement. That is a $560,000 request. There's two state planners included in that. We've discovered over the years that as the missions for the National Guard have gotten more complicated, including longer-term missions like the Republican National Convention and those sorts of things, pandemic and avian flu planning, we have a need for a more stable staff that can make those relationships with the other state agencies so we understand what their needs are when the National Guard is called to service. It used to be that you could call out people and 24 hours later they'd probably be on duty and ready to go, but the missions have gotten much more challenging and much more complicated and require much more coordination between state agencies. So we would ask that we be funded for those two state planners. The other employee is a state quartermaster, essentially the property manager. We were doing that with a part-time employee located at Camp Ripley. One of the things we've discovered since 9/11 is that because of all the deployments of the National Guard units, we've essentially not turned over the property accountability from the outgoing people to the incoming people. We just haven't had the staff to do that and hadn't anticipated that, but of course the reality is that's the way of the world for the next few years anyway. And we also have discovered that as part of the cooperative agreements with the federal government, when we purchase property equipment, the state is responsible to account for that. It's not done on the federal side because we're using federal money through a cooperative agreement. The onus is on the state to account for that. So it's gotten much more complicated, especially with all the new technology that's coming out. And the final budget request change item in that appropriation is for the reintegration. That's a $1.5 million request for one-time funding. As Colonel Kelly has talked about, there are significant challenges that the National Guard faces that the active components don't face, and that is our soldiers are located all around the state because of the dispersion of where they live. We don't have a simple place that everyone can go to for the services that they be required. And the Adjutant General has been very adamant about the need for the National Guard to take care of its members as they return from missions, to help them become full participating members in their family, community, and in their work life again. And that's what this money is intended to do, is provide those services and those training opportunities that these people will need, them and their families, to get back to a productive life again. And then the final recommendation for our program is the Enlistment Incentives Program. That is a critical program for the National Guard to maintain its membership. We appreciate the support of the legislature in the state of Minnesota and the taxpayers in funding these programs, and we believe that has played a great role in the success of the Minnesota Guard in maintaining its membership and attracting new members, and I think we've been number one in recruiting for several years, and we owe a great deal of that to this tuition reimbursement and enlistment incentives program. That's a $20.414 million. There's no change in that one. There's about 2,674 members last year used the tuition reimbursement program, so it's a very important program. It rewards people for service. It also rewards them for completion of the coursework. They don't get any money unless they've actually completed the coursework and maintained a C-level grade in that course. And then the reenlistment bonus program, which was instituted last year, about 480 members use that program. That concentrates more on the mid-career people who either have completed college or are not interested in attending college, and But we definitely need them and their skills in the Minnesota Guard and want to retain those.
Did you serve with Howard Miller?
No, I didn't.
Okay, we actually, that reenlistment program should be subtitled the Howard Miller Memorial Program. He was the one who thought of it. And we were being asked to just put reenlistment bonuses out, and he said, we ought to get something for them. Let's make them go to school. And that was the genesis of that program.
Well, Madam Chair, to that.
So, you know, it's like the things that Frankie does, you know, stop the clock is twice a day.
Mr. Crankie was right more than twice a day.
What?
He was right more than twice a day.
Yes. Miller also, but this was his big contribution.
Madam Chair, if I could have, to that point, the reenlistment bonus is not a tuition bonus, though, is it not? It's separate, correct? Yes. There's a tuition reimbursement program. And then the bonus is a much different program than the tuition reimbursement.
Madam Chair, Representative Scrivin, that's correct. They are two separate programs focusing on two different categories of our soldiers.
And those are basically the two programs, Madam Chair, that we have for our incentive, reenlistment incentives. Those are the two programs. Madam Chair, the last question, I guess, is as we're going through the budget overview, everything that you have requested here or that has been mentioned by you in the last 5 minutes is part of the Governor's recommendation, Governor Flanagan's recommendation, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Slayton, that is correct. This is the Governor's budget.
This is the Governor's budget.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Okay. One other item that this is a program that's run by the National Guard. I know people were going to we discussed it last year, and this is called Minnesota Starbase. And I'll start with a confession. I mean, the conflict of interest is that I'm a member of the board of Minnesota Starbase. So we'll start from there. Former Representative Harry Sieben is also a member of this. This committee did put maybe Representative Keppel and maybe Bill Forrest, the many people who went. This committee did do a field trip to watch Starbase when we had some time last year and worked and was instead. It was passed last year for an expansion, and I'll let these. What happened was that we passed it last year. I think it was the highest recommendation from this committee for capital investment. It went into the bonding bill with bonding money for planning and pre-design, and because of these people here will tell us about the complications, which means you need to shift back to general funds. Bonding doesn't work, it makes federal, state, airport ownership. So please say who you are, and I think you have some handouts for us.
My name is John Solomon. I'm a retired Brigadier General. I was the commander of the 133rd Airlift Wing. And I am a member of the Board of Directors of Starbase and have maintained that association because I really believe in the program and I've seen the success of the program. And we'd like it to move forward. We really appreciate the intent of the state legislature and appropriating $150,000 of bonding money. As we moved into looking at how to access that money, Starbase had a meeting with the Department of Military Affairs represented by Mr. Terry Palmer and also representatives from the Department of Finance, Mr. Peter Sawson and Ms. Jane Rankin, and also the Attorney General's Office, Mr. Bill Koretsky. As we talked about utilizing bonding money for pre-design and design for an expansion project of Starbase, it became very apparent to us that because of the restrictions of the Minnesota State Constitution and the legalities of building a state building on federal property, even though that property is licensed to the state for training for the Air National Guard, it really became an impossible task to access that money. So what we're here today to do is to talk to you about putting $150,000 in general fund obligations to move forward with the expansion project at Starbase. We did explore the legal requirements, as I mentioned, and they just became too complicated when you're trying to access the federal property using state money. So the general funding, according to Mr. Peter Sawson, would be much easier to utilize, and we could move forward with our expansion plans at Starbase.
Okay. Yeah, but Ms. Van Lee, would you like to make some comments too?
Yes. Good morning.
Say who you are.
I am Kim Van Lee. I'm the executive director of Starbase Minnesota, and I know several of the committee members came out last year to visit the organization, and we really appreciate that and invite all committee members, if there's any others that would like to come out this year, new committee members, to see what that organization is about. But as you can see in the handout right there, we are serving inner city schools, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and we're serving 2,500 to 2,600 students a year. Most of them are economically disadvantaged children of color, and the learning really comes alive at Starbase. It's a very hands-on program, focuses on science, math, and technology, and even engineering, exposing students to careers as well. And it's standards-based, inquiry-based, and we have a long waiting list of schools wanting to attend, and that's the reason for expansion. With this pre-designed money, we can create an expanded facility that can serve up to 4,500 kids a year. So I appreciate your support, and please let us know if you have any further questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Testifiers, sounds like a wonderful, exciting program. When you would say that the expansion would be allowed to 4,500 students, is that still going to be a metropolitan area, or is it talking about outstate Minnesota as well?
We did a demographic study several years ago looking at Duluth and Rochester, and also the increased demand in the Twin Cities area. And we found that the greatest demand is right here in the metropolitan area. Starbase really touches only a portion of the people would really like to be able to participate in the Starbase program. So that's why we're looking at expanding in this area versus Duluth or Rochester or other outstate areas, because we can touch more people and with fewer funds.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm always interested in performance, and with the 4th, 5th, 6th graders that you've had in Starbase for, you know, what, some 15, 14, 12 years, whatever it is, have you ever done an assessment as to how many of those children have gone back and finished school, gone on to some graduate programs, dropped out on the other end of school? Have you ever done an assessment as to any of the children that have gone to Starbase and the success of those kids versus kids who have not attended this year?
Madam Chair and committee members, it's an excellent question, and it's always been an interest of ours to do that. We had gone back to the Department of Defense to ask if we could do a longitudinal study such as this, and they weren't able to provide the funding for that. For a while they were intending to, and then they changed their mind about that. We have data on pre- and post-test scores, which are short-term indicators. Last year we did a mid-range study, I should call it, and that is to find out what happened to students 3 to 5 months after the Starbase program. Are they retaining the information? Are they retaining the excitement about science and math and technology? And what we found is that the students were really retaining that information, and some students even scored higher on the post-test score, on the post-test when we gave the assessment again to them 3 to 5 months later, which indicates that their interest in science and math is being sustained by the school district after it's ignited at Starbase. So that was very encouraging. That was just an intermediate range study, but in doing that, it helped create kind of the model for a longitudinal study as well. So we took that information and all the data reports that we have. We've got a great database capabilities and assessment capabilities at Starbase. And we proposed to the Wilder Foundation the idea of doing a longitudinal study. And because we have some great data, we've been tracking this data, and we have permission from the school districts to look into the, well, we have permission from the school districts to actually use and track the student ID numbers, because in a highly mobile school district, that's what you need in order to kind of track the students. So we have all the elements in place to do the longitudinal study. And Wilder said they'd be very excited to do the study. Our challenge now is to come up with $25,000 to do the study. So that's our next step. Yep, $25,000.
That's
the chump
change.
I hear. Whenever the Speaker Emeritus says something's chump change, it's similar when I went with this group of people to Washington to talk about doubling the program in Washington. It's the first time we met with four members of Congress at that time: Coleman, McCollum, Sabo, and Dayton. Two on their way out, actually. Besides Representative McCollum expressing extreme surprise at my coming into her office for a military-oriented project. And Senator Coleman directing the study to both of our love of the former Brooklyn Dodgers. I've never seen in any trip to Washington, first of all, nobody put a staff person off on us, but I've never seen such, every congressman that we talked to said, what can I do to help? So it's a...
Madam Chair, Senator Coleman was not alive when the Dodgers were in trouble.
As I always remind people, there's one positive statement I can always make about Senator Coleman, which is that my mother taught him high school biology. So.
Madam Chair, the question just begs to have you do this study, whether it's we find 25,000 or Wilder does. I'm just going to guess that you're going to find some very remarkable and good results that will tell you a certain number of your students go on or graduate a greater or higher percentage than those who don't participate. I think you'd want to know that.
We definitely do.
It would be your selling point. It'd be your market. It'd be your, you come here, you wouldn't ask for $150,000, you'd ask for $15 million, Do it somehow.
Yeah, okay. Well, I would point, one of the things that impressed me, I think it was one of the things that was used in asking me to be on the board, was that one of the board members told me that she was told, meeting the kids who were going into the sixth grade programs, one little girl told her she had been waiting for this day since fourth grade, when they had done it in fourth grade and was then knowing she could be back at sixth grade. So, okay. Well, the appropriation for Starbase, the 150, and maybe following Representative Sigmund's discussion, extra money for the study will be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much. I guess next, again, because Ms. Lynch has someone that needs to go. The next bill, John, the next, bill is mine, 1440 on, pay equity compliance.
Representative Kahn, do you want to move your bill, please?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd move that there is an amendment, again, with this same problem of kind of putting a bill through financing, getting it not quite through. The bill went from Representative, this is an amendment which has also been adopted in the Senate, which moves it to the to employee relations, which has done most of the pay equity work. So at least at this point, I'd move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape of this committee. I thought that this was done somehow. I thought that the bill was already in this form, but because it doesn't go to the floor, it doesn't get any breakfast, I guess, is the answer. So I'd like to move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the form that this committee should.
The A1 amendment has been moved by Representative Kahn. Is there any discussion or questions on the amendment? See none, so moved. You want to discuss your bill, please, moving forward?
Okay, yes. So I guess the A1 amendment is now adopted. And we'll, and I'll give, introduce Ms. Bonnie Watkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bonnie Watkins, and I'm here today for the Pay Equity Coalition of Minnesota. I was actually here 23 years ago, as a few of you may remember, talking about the Pay Equity for Local Governments law, and it's a pleasure to be back. After you all passed that law, I became the Pay Equity Coordinator at DUER for about 6 years, helping about 1,500 local governments implement that pay equity law. And I also helped write the rule that was promulgated in 1990, I believe. So I thought I would just very quickly walk through what is in the bill, and my comments really refer to the amendment as well as everything else. The purpose of the bill is to extend pay equity to businesses that are seeking to provide goods and services to state government, to ensure that there is not a pattern of lower pay for jobs performed by women. The bill is related to other requirements that are already placed on state contractors. There's a requirement they must have affirmative action plans, which are certified by the state, as well as related to those other pay equity laws that have been in place for the state of Minnesota and for 1,500 local government entities, cities, counties, and school districts in the state. Those laws actually have done a wonderful job of reducing the earnings gap between men and women within their jurisdictions. However, there is still a huge overall earnings gap for women in this state because the vast majority of Minnesotans work in the private sector. So Section 1, just walking through, is the basic requirement of this bill that businesses that are seeking large state contracts must prepare a plan to achieve pay equity and submit that plan to the Department of Employee Relations. With the change, it would move to DUER. This would be limited to contracts for more than $100,000 and businesses having more than 40 full-time employees in Minnesota. The Department of Administration, I understand, says that there are about 1,500 businesses that would be covered. So it's about the same size population we've been working with the local governments. Subdivision 2 sets the compliance standard by referring to that Local Government Pay Equity Act. And so this is a standard that's been used for a long time. And I'm just lifting a little language from the law to define that standard a little further for you. That law says equitable compensation relationship means that the compensation for female-dominated classes is not consistently below the compensation for male-dominated classes of comparable work value. So that not consistently below is kind of awkward language, but I think very important in knowing what we're up to here. The bill also incorporates the administrative rule that has some really fancy math about how this is done. Subdivision 2 recognizes that not all state contractors can do these studies and achieve pay equity overnight. The commissioner can certify businesses that are making a good faith effort to move in the direction of pay equity. And there's a later section that defines good faith effort even more simply in the first year of the program. Subdivision 3 establishes a filing fee, $75 for each business seeking certification, which is the same level as the fee now used for the affirmative action. This funds the position within DUER that is needed to oversee the process and assist the employers. Subdivisions 4 through 6 explain how certificates can be revoked and contracts can be revoked if the pay equity standards are not met or the good faith efforts are not being made. And obviously, it's in everyone's interest to avoid this situation. Nobody wants that to ever happen. And that's partly why Subdivision 6 provides for some technical assistance to the employers, very similar to all kinds of assistance and training that are already being provided to local governments. Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, I've been informed that one more change that needs to be made is that we should, when it comes to actually revoking contracts, that should refer to the Commissioner of Administration, because the Department of Employee Relations would certify people who then go in the pool. So I don't know if you want to do that now or later.
Well, we can just make sure that we understand.
Get back to that, okay.
Yes,
sir. Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Shepard understands.
Okay. Subdivision 7 would protect the businesses, or is designed to protect the businesses by keeping their salary data private, except as needed by the Department of Employee Relations. Section 2 has again been added to assist the businesses in the early stages, knowing that it takes people time to get up to speed. In the first year of this program, a business would be judged to be making a good faith effort if it simply expresses an intention to prepare a pay equity report and answers three very simple questions. This is how we have done pay equity in Minnesota that has worked very, very well. That just recognizing that movement in the right direction is far preferable to sort of a gotcha approach or waiting until a perfect system is in place, because many other states have discovered if you wait for perfection, you don't do very well. So, Section 3 is also new in the amendment. It requires the Dewar Commissioner to report next January on how this program is going. If she discovers that there is some huge obstacle why this can't be done because of whatever differences there might be between the private sector and the public sector, or if she needs additional resources, that would be a great time to come back and let you all know of any changes that might be needed. And Section 4 establishes this coming July as the effective date. So I would like to go on a little bit if we have time and refer to what I think is the core of this. Sure. You should have in your handouts a packet that says testimony in support of the pay equity for contractors bill. A couple of flashy graphs on the front page. And I won't review all this. The first just reviews the fact that earnings for men and women have increased a lot in the last 50 years. But actually the earnings gap really has not changed a heck of a lot. So that's good to know. I also have to give a couple examples from what we've been through in the past, because we talk a lot about patterns, but there are real people involved, and these are the kind of real people you don't get to see in rooms like this very often. There are women who are out there hard at work today. So a couple of the people who were affected in the past, in state government we found, for example, that human service technicians in state hospitals were paid less than zookeepers who were taking care of people in the state zoo. And when we thought about it and looked at it, we didn't think that really did reflect the state's priorities. The human service techs, of course, were mostly women, and the zookeepers were mostly men. Another thing we discovered way back when was that many women who worked for the state were eligible for food stamps. And that, again, kind of opened our eyes to say, gee, you know, we can talk about all the factors that influence pay setting, but the government pays with another hand for things that we don't pay in salaries. And the library director example here, there was a woman, you might remember, a couple of you, who came down from northern Minnesota. She was the director of a library in a small city. She managed the budget. She reported to the city council. She supervised some employees. She ordered books. And she came down in person to say that she was paid less than the guy who mowed the lawn outside the library. I'm assuming it was a city maintenance worker. Not to say anything bad about that guy and not to say his pay should be reduced. But that woman spoke very sadly and said she'd been doing this for 40-some years. She was about to retire, so the law wasn't going to do her personally a lick of good. And she realized, though, that her pension was going to be much smaller for the whole rest of her life because of that really gross underpayment. So those are real people. Let me just ask you to look, and I'm really going to wrap this up quickly, at the next page where these scattergrams. These are the actual things we brought before you some years ago. The first one, Minnesota state government before pay equity. These are just graphs. Going across the bottom are job evaluation points. So not surprisingly, the higher the points are, the higher the pay tends to be for everybody. Going up on the left-hand side is the maximum monthly pay for each job class, so increased pay. And then each little point on this graph is one job class, not an individual. In state government, one job class might have 10 people in it, or it might have 1,000 people in it. So it's very important. We're not talking about John Doe and Jane and Smith here. We're talking about huge classes in many cases. But each little asterisk is a male-dominated job class. And each little F is a female-dominated job class. So this picture before state government, of course, in state government, as everywhere, there are many, many factors that influence pay setting. There certainly is supply and demand and labor market issues. In state government, of course, collective bargaining is a gigantic factor, and there are lots of other factors. We tend to think supervisors should be paid more than the people they supervise, for example. But what amazed, I think, all of us who were studying this back then was that how consistent that pattern was, that every single female-dominated job was paid less than just about every single male-dominated job. So that pattern is what pay equity is really designed to get at, not one-to-one job comparisons. And similarly, the after picture really shows you what the state has been maintaining ever since, that the male jobs continue to scatter. There's no kind of lockstep pay-for-points formula here. The female jobs scatter. However, the female jobs are not always below the male jobs, and that's just about what we're aiming at. Just two other quick notes. I think the last page is the 30 largest state contractors, just to give you the flavor for who we're talking about, and you can see that we're talking about a really large employer and a really large amount of money, and we hope an awful lot of women who stand to benefit. I also asked the staff to put in your packets a two-page report form that Dewar has been using for the local governments. Obviously, the first page would be different for the private people, but the second page is a very simple list of, you know, who works for you, are they men, are they women, and how much are they paid, and what is your, the employer chooses the job value, and the employer sets the pay, but this gives them an opportunity to review that through that gender-based lens. So, in conclusion, committee members, I really thank you for considering this bill. It's kind of a small step forward in lots of ways. We think it's very reasonable and doable, and we've proved we can do pay equity in Minnesota. But it's not going to happen unless we start somewhere. The women who deserve this recognition for their valuable work cannot be here today. They can hardly ever be here. They're out there holding down very challenging and valuable jobs. And in many cases, they're also holding together families and being caregivers for children and older people, and it doesn't seem like they should be penalized for that. They're already the backbone of Minnesota's economy. They just simply deserve to have their work better recognized. And furthermore, I think the state deserves to work with good, solid contractors who pay fair wages without historic gender bias. And we also need to make sure that we are not supporting employers who provide, who pay people so low, so little that they're qualifying for government benefits. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Watkins, for wonderful testimony.
Thank you.
Any members, are there questions? Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Watkins. I, my question for you is, I'm 34 years old. I grew up in a little bit different environment from folks who have been fighting on this issue for a long time. And so I have a little bit different perspective in terms of what I've seen based on what people have seen who have been fighting this since the 50s and 70s. And I also know, in trying to determine, I'm looking at these graphs at the top of the page, and I know that anytime you're comparing two groups, you're going to have some deviation between the groups. And I know that even if we had perfect pay equity in Minnesota across all ages, genders, and jobs, there's going to be, at any given time you measure, a difference between the groups. And ideally, women's pay is going to be a little bit higher at a certain point, and then men's pay is going to be a little higher. And that difference represents the standard deviation, as I understand it statistically. So do you have a number, or do you know what that is, that if we had perfect pay equity in Minnesota, what would that standard deviation be, such that at any given time we looked at it, and the acceptable deviation would be in a point where we said, okay, well, there's a little bit of difference here, but it's just because of the standard deviation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swash, thank you. We actually had a wonderful PhD math professor help us adopt a rule, and at one time I understood all the math, so I'll have to give you the short version. Yes, there is no such thing as perfect pay equity, of course. So you have to have a statistical way to know whether something could have happened by chance or is likely to have happened because of chance. And the standard we adopted in the 80-page rule is called the 4/5 rule. It's been used for a lot of other discrimination work. And the general rule, but it's got all kinds of tests of significance and stuff, the general rule is that if the female classes in this picture, if they were paid below the men more than 80% of the time, that would be very hard to attribute to chance. So that's the statistical measure. And, of course, it becomes a better measure in a larger business where you have more points on the graph. So there's tests of significance. There's lots of that kind of stuff. But believe me, I think we really bend over backwards to make that standard easy to meet from the employer's point of view. I should also mention that, remember, these are employers who've been doing affirmative action plans for years and years. So maybe they don't have male-dominated and female-dominated classes anymore. You know, maybe half the bank tellers are women and half are men now. Those classes don't even appear on the graph. The other thing is that, let me see, there's one other factor. How we define those to be a male or female-dominated class, at least 70% of the people in the class must be men or women. So that's a pretty high definition. We're not talking 51% here.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Horman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thought it was worth noting when we're looking at this attachment to the graph, you've listed the top 30 state suppliers by amount of payments. And number one is J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, New York. Number two is Wells Fargo Bank. We pay J.P. Morgan Chase Bank annually $627 million, $643,248. Representative Kahn, I don't know if you know, does that denote interest payments on debt?
Representative Kahn?
So there is somebody at the Department of Administration who might...
Ms. Watkins? Thank you. Can you please identify yourself for the tape?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the Director of the Materials Management Division in the Department of Administration. Administration was the source of this data, and all we did to obtain it is to look at the state's accounting and procurement system and identify who the most significant payments had gone to. So it would include anything at all that the state of Minnesota might have paid to these particular suppliers. So in this case, yes, it would include interest on debt and anything else that we would be paying to a banking organization.
Thank you.
Representative Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Some years ago, I think at that time there was only probably Representative Kahn and Mr. Shepard and I in this room that might have been here with you. What year was it we did the local government pay equity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Slagle, 1984. 1982 was the state government.
Sometimes being around for too long a period of time, your institutional memory fades, and sometimes it's very good. Let me give you my perspective of what took place back there in 83-84 at that time, and I obviously opposed the local government pay equity provision bill. I had made the statements that I think the state government doing pay equity is a good thing. We should lead by example in the state, but we shouldn't do the unfunded mandate, which turned out to be an unfunded mandate on our local governments. And it didn't go quite as smooth as you seem to indicate, at least from my cities and counties that were involved. But I remember very, very well, and I think we can go back and find the tapes. Are the state tapes still available from 84, Representative Kahn?
Representative Kahn?
I haven't listened to them.
Are they available?
Probably.
I remember very well the discussions, being in committee and floor and in caucuses and around here that, okay, we'll mandate local governments, but we'll never, ever, ever get into the private sector. Not going to happen. Don't worry about it. This bill will pass, but we will never do the private sector. The private sector will live alone. We have some responsibility from government standpoint, but the market will take place in the private sector. We're not going to do mandates. We're not going to be negative to the private sector. I remember those discussions very, very well. And I'm going to start searching for those tapes. Now, hopefully it was in committees, not in caucuses or, you know, in discussions, so I can find the tapes. But can Representative Kahn, do you remember those discussions?
Yes.
Actually, we
both might have what Representative Rukavina describes as Iron Range Alzheimer's, which is you forget everything except the grudges.
That's a true Iron Range.
And
that's a quote, Mr. Chairman, that's a quote of Rukavina. I don't want it attributed to me.
Understand, Representative Kahn?
Although, but Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Kahn?
I'll just point out that this is not moving it to the private sector, this is only dealing with contracts, state contracts that the private sector has with the state.
Mr. Chairman, I disagree with that completely.
Okay.
It's saying that if you want to do any work with the state of Minnesota in any way, shape, or form, it's a mandate from the private sector. It is moving it to the private sector, absolutely, without question. Now, I've been in, out of this list of 30 businesses here, I've been in half of them in the last year, either in their corporate offices or with their employees, with a significant number of people from at least half of them. And I will tell you that not one person in the 15 of these people that I've been Wells Fargo, I've been Blue Cross Blue Shield, I've been Zumbro River, I've been in Lunda, Schaefer, Bowerly, Ames, McCross, and Wells Fargo, Dunnock, West, and not one person, man or woman, in any of those businesses that I've been in the corporate offices, or has mentioned the concern, an issue, an upsetness, bring this bill forward to us, for us. Not one person has mentioned it to me in the 15 I've been in the last year.
Mr. Chairman, why does that statement not surprise me?
It doesn't surprise me.
You're talking, Mr. Chairman, you're talking to the corporate offices head, and other people are talking to the people who are down in the trenches.
Oh, that's not true.
Okay.
That's not true. In many of these places, I've spoken to their employees, to the groups of employees, the gatherings, a pizza and lunch type thing. Okay. So that's simply not true.
Okay. Excuse me.
We have one more question. Representative Strigum, when you find those tapes, I think finding the tapes would be easy part. The tough part will find something to play them on, probably. Representative,
I'm not going to have the time to find the tapes, but Mr. Shepherd? You got time, but
oh, yeah.
Searching, will you?
Representative Zellers.
Mr. Chairman.
Oops.
Just point out that I think that that's an appropriate request to the Legislative Reference Library, and I think they have the people who do that. And, Mr. Chairman, I would like to point out that there is someone here who's probably, I think, going to express something along with Representative Sligum's views, and so it might be good to hear his testimony.
Okay. We'll go to Representative Zona's questions first, please.
Sure. I just, for Ms. Watkins, you mentioned other states have done this. Does any other state have a law like we're proposing today? Not a variation, a law as strict and strident as this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zeller,
Ms. Watkins,
I believe not. I do think that the Canada has a law that applies to all private employers in the nation of Canada. They invited us up to talk about what we were doing some time ago. There are also, yes, I guess I don't know of any states that do contractors.
And then,
sure.
The existing law for intentional sex discrimination on the books right now, is it not being used? Is it being abused? Are the complaints that are being filed not being properly adjudicated? Or I guess I'm asking if there's already existing statute to prevent this, to provide remedies for folks, why are we layering yet another? And I agree with Speaker's Emeritus Sligum that this is another unfunded mandate. And looking down the list, I counted 16 of the 18. There's a few that I didn't know are Minnesota companies. We're going to have other, you know, folks like J.P. Morgan and some of these bigger companies that will write to spec and push a number of our Minnesota companies, and there's a couple in there, especially up in my neck of the woods, that I'd rather see our local Minnesota companies get these contracts. But if they can't write exactly to spec like some other outside or out-of-state contractors, we're going to force Minnesota companies out of government contracts. And to me, it's wrong-headed and twofold. But I just, back to my original question without the commentary, the intentional sex discrimination statutes that are on the books.
Ms. Watkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, first of all, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a human rights complainant, so I can't speak very directly, but it's my understanding that, that the process is very different, that to file a human rights charge is something that is very complaint-driven. One person at a time has to go through the process, and that it is still a fairly long and cumbersome process for people. I'm not in a position to know how well it's working, but this is really intended to be in a less legalistic forum, for lack of a better word, to give employers the chance to proactively, much like affirmative action, fix the problem before it's a problem. And if I were an employer, quite frankly, I would like to have this kind of data to, in case somebody sued me, I could defend myself using this kind of information. I guess my only other thought about the interfering with the private sector, and this is partly a response to Representative Sligo. Back in 84, I believe there were only 5 people who voted against this bill. So it was not universally considered a party issue then. I was very happy that there was bipartisan support at that time. In terms of the who employers compare themselves to, I just have to mention that these are bidders right now who are bidding for things that could have conceivably been done by state or local governments. And so they, I hope, are also comparing themselves to how the state pays administrative assistants and how the state pays research analysts and so on. So that there's lots of comparisons, and we just need people to look at the whole range.
Ms. Zars?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the best of my knowledge, this hasn't been heard in any policy committee, Representative Khan, or Chair Khan. It has not. And we kind of went far and afray from what the answer I was looking for. You're advocating for pay equity, yet when we're discussing what's on the books right now, what's happening right now, you're not able to answer, or not, at least not addressing per se. And with Representative Lesh, maybe we grew up in a different era where we see our coworkers as equals and don't have some of those social mores from, what do you say, the 60s or 70s, John? Whatever it may be.
80s, I think we were looking at.
Okay. I was born then. This seems to me is we're going to force Minnesota companies to be disqualified, and just like Speaker Mayor Sigmund said, this wasn't going to come to the private sector, and when you said it won't come now from there into the private sector as a mandate, I would say yet. Maybe it took 20 years, maybe it took 25 years, maybe the next time it won't take as long, but these unfunded mandates and forcing Minnesota companies to be disqualified to me is very wrongheaded, and unfortunately, if it hasn't seen it in a policy committee, I would say that it at least should make a stop in a policy committee, not just our finance committee, with all due respect to the chair.
We have another question from a member, and then we're going to go to testifying out in the audience. So this will be Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, Representative Zellers, perhaps, though we're in the very same age category, you haven't seen this because you're men and not women. And I can tell you that this is still needed, and that there are definitely times in my employment history where men doing very similar work, if not the same work, have been paid at a higher rate because of the presumption that either they need to care for a family, they need to save for an engagement ring. This is out there. This is alive and well. It hasn't bypassed your generation. It's bypassed your gender.
Thank you, Representative Hartman.
Okay.
Well, do we have testimony from the audience that would like to respond, reply? Would you please identify yourself for the tape, please, as you begin your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Robert Reinhart. I'm an attorney and partner with Dorsey & Whitney, the state's largest law firm, but don't hold that against us. Until a few weeks ago, when I had been practicing in Minnesota for over 30 years in the specialty of labor and employment law, I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Employment Law Council. It's a group of 15 to 18 of the state's largest employers who have come together largely to try to follow developments of state law in Minnesota, and this bill has caught our attention because we think it's a fundamentally bad idea. I think all of us have had an opportunity when we look at the television to reflect on the irrationality of how much a rock star or an athlete makes in comparison to a school teacher. You don't have to be the proud father of one of the best elementary school teachers in the state of Minnesota to be struck with the fact that there's something fundamentally inequitable about what she gets paid and what I get paid. The issue here is not discrimination or eliminating, as the mathematicians can try to do, the possibility of chance as another is the only innocent explanation for a selection pattern that looks like it's biased, because we already do have laws that address that. This bill addresses a very different issue that's remarkably simple to express. Can employers base their wage rates on the market? We can look at the classic apples and oranges and say that by some measure of the hay people or some taste tester or some nutrition expert, apples and oranges have the same value. We could debate it. You could say you like apples more because they're produced in Minnesota, or you could say you like oranges more because they have more vitamin C. But somebody, I promise you, can come in and with an ostensibly objective measure say that these two pieces of fruit are worth the same. And yet if there's weather conditions in California, oranges can cost a lot more. You could try to legislate that it isn't equitable to charge different for apples and oranges, but the simple fact is the market is there. When the assertion is made that public and private employment are indistinguishable, I really struggle to try to understand how someone can conclude that. Because if the state of Minnesota decides that for good public policy reasons it wants to raise the wage rates of certain jobs, it can do so at the expense only of the taxpayers, and you're all stewards of the resources of the state, and that's an issue. But the core mission of the state will maybe be enhanced, because if you pay more for a job, you arguably will get more qualified people. In the private sector, if you pay more for a job, you may very well get more qualified people, but you may also fail of your core mission, which is all about the marketplace. The mission of a private employer is to succeed in the marketplace. To tell a private employer that in the name of fairness, trying to rationalize prices in our society, the state government's going to set prices in certain markets without regard to the supply and demand for labor in that function, is to fundamentally threaten the core mission of a private employer. So the concern I'm here to express is not to tweak around the edges, it's to raise the fundamental reason why 25 years ago, the whole nation was debating comparable worth. My career started in the 70s, and I spent the first decade of my life very much addressing issues of equal pay and comparable pay. It crescendoed in a United States Supreme Court decision involving the state of Washington in 1981. It did feature some debate here at the state. But the reason why every single state and every federal court that I'm aware of and the United States Supreme Court has moved away from notions that government can embrace within notions of discrimination, comparable worth, is because the courts and the legislatures have consistently recognized, as I gather this one did, that it is just not realistic or possible in a global marketplace and economy for Minnesota to sit here and say, if you want to deliver banking services to us, which we otherwise find to be in our best interest to purchase, and you're operating in New York and all around the world, you have to study all your jobs and bring in a mathematician to try to figure out what would be a fair and equitable way to make proportional the jobs, the pay for all those jobs. This regulatory system not only asks for equal pay for equal or comparable jobs, which is what was controversial 25 years ago, but it goes beyond and says if some job is worth 80% of another job, it should get paid 80%. To have a centrally planned set of prices for labor or goods is just something that I think our society has found is not realistic. It does raise profound issues. This is not a minor matter of just applying to the private sector what was done in the public sector. It is of great concern to the members I'm speaking here about. I'm dismayed that we haven't, shame on us, we haven't picked up on this sooner, and if it was heard in another committee before this one, we missed it. But this is something that bears careful study if it's to be considered seriously at all. The example that was provided of these different kind of jobs that seem like they should be paid differently, if the supply of workers who want to do that job is different, then the market price is going to be different. If the market is the same, but the employer is just choosing to pay a female-dominated job differently, that is intentional discrimination. The courts know how to deal with it, and they do deal with it. I would suggest that the core, and since we're of limited time, and we could devote a week conference to the subject, but the core way that the society has made dramatic strides, not yet enough, I would probably agree with, without scientific basis, to assure better opportunity among all the protected classes that the law works hard to protect, and focusing on gender issues, is to open doors. to make sure that jobs in every labor market are equally available to everybody, and to ferret out, by all the sophisticated means that the courts have developed over the long course of my career, to figure out if there is intentional discrimination. And if there are jobs that draw from the same labor pool, even though they're titled differently, have little different job titles, then the courts know how to deal with it. But to say that a company has a price of trying to deliver services the state needs, needs to study itself up and down in all locations, is that bank in New York, or the little stamp making, I have a small client that's privately held in New Hope, that does work in New Hope and St. Paul, stamping out products. It's a very modest sized company, but 50% of its operations are in China. Not contracting out the labor to sell goods in the United States, but they make and sell things in China. Are they to be accountable for how they pay in China as well as here, because they deal with the state if they do? There are, as you move down more deeply into the implications of this bill, much more that can be said, but the fundamental issue is that I urge you not to take away from the employer the defense to a charge of pay bias on paying on the basis of the market. If I can demonstrate that I can pay on the basis of the market, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is our federal court, the United States Supreme Court, and the Minnesota Court of Appeals have all said that is fair. That is equitable. We are not here to try to set prices from the state capitol. That's the fundamental objection we have to that, and I welcome your question.
Thank you, Mr. Reinhart. And we have a question from Senator Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I should start with the disclosure that the fine work that Mr. Reinhart does at his law firm helps to pay my mortgage at home for my wife's salary. Despite that, it's not quite a softball question. A couple of things. First, I guess my first question would be, wouldn't all of the same arguments that you just made apply equally to requiring affirmative action plans?
No, because affirmative action plans, you can debate what that means, but I've always understood it with the metaphor that it's like a requirement to cast a wide net. Sometimes in the public discourse it gets to be expressing absolute preference for candidates, but in my sense the enlightened view of affirmative action that's been accepted by the Supreme Court is you make sure you go out of your way to cast a wide net so that you're not jumping to conclusions about who to pick because you're tapping the old boy network. You're trying to make sure you are in touch with and are recruiting actively people who are qualified and interested to do this job, and once you've done that, you've met the requirement, now you pick the best person.
It seems to me that what the bill does then is to require employers to simply ask the question. In fact, there's no requirement that they actually have implemented a full pay equity program, merely that they are moving in good faith towards doing so, and that they have to go through the process of evaluating job classifications, which I think they already have to put together, and job descriptions, which they already have to put together. And many of the resources to do this are going to be provided free from the state. So in some ways, I sort of see it as the same. You're not requiring or mandating a particular outcome. You're merely asking that they go through and ask themselves the question and do the evaluation. And I guess the other question to Mr. Reinhart would be, as far as, do you see this as an administrative burden that is particularly more challenging than filing an affirmative action plan, going through those steps? It seems to me that they've made great efforts to keep the administrative burden pretty light for the employers.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Reinhart.
Representative Winkler, I purposely didn't say anything about the administrative challenges of compliance because I see it to be so secondary to the fundamental policy problems here. I think the administrative burden would not be insubstantial. How it would compare to affirmative action would be hard to hazard a quick, glib answer because that's an enormously administratively challenging requirement. Affirmative action requirements go all to opening the doors. They go all to casting the wide net and making sure that there's every effort made to have a relatively to have those who are selected represent and reflect the available labor pool as closely as reasonably possible. It's not about dictating pay that people get or dictating who gets chosen. Your question, though, had to do with whether or not you're just asking the question or making a commitment. As I read this, an employer must satisfy in good faith that they are committing to a result. They're saying that they won't get done overnight. There's some contemplation it'll take a little time, but eventually the contractor is saying as they submit the bid, I will eventually try to get some academic person to rate, in an abstract sense, an objective notion of beauty. It can be in the idea holder, but we'll try to take out subjectivity and say, in terms of skill, effort, responsibility, and working conditions, this is what these jobs are worth, and we're going to pay accordingly. And the employer, in good faith, can't sign that if they say, I don't, regardless of what what the skill, effort, responsibility, and working conditions are. If there's a scarce labor pool, this job I really need, I got to pay what I got to pay to get it. And if there's a abundant labor pool and I don't have to pay so much, I have to be able to be free to say the market has to influence me, because my whole core mission is to penetrate this market for a market share that will deliver success to my company or we go out of business.
And members, we do have members that need to leave, that we need to hear their bill as well. So can we, is there any other dialogue or questions on this? Members and Zellers?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I apologize, I forgot your name, sir.
Rob Reinhart.
Mr. Reinhart?
Mr. Reinhart, I'm sorry. So, and just a quick question, and Mr. Winkler, this really isn't a softball. What regulatory increases in the employer or in bidding process will we see because of this? Just on the policy on one side, but on the administrative penalties on the other. I mean, are Minnesota companies going to opt out of applying for these Minnesota contracts? Is it going to raise our price? In other words, the price the taxpayer is going to pay.
And Mr. Reiner, can you answer real quickly?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Zellers. I have nothing in the way of data to present, but I'm quite confident that the pool of interested bidders will reduce sharply. I would see it as kind of a professional responsibility on my part to educate our clients to the implications of undertaking job evaluation in the way that's suggested, because the courts have said once you do it, then it's going to be used as evidence. The bill says it will be used as evidence about pay bias and so forth. So that part, the part about the administrative burden, which was suggested by Representative Winkler's question and yours, is one that I know is prodigious. I know the existing staff is not going to be able to handle it if Chase and Wells Fargo and 3M and everybody starts submitting reports evaluating all the thousands and thousands of jobs they have and comparing them all to each other and trying to set raise rates on the basis of that. It's just got to be a big job. But frankly, the bigger problem is that you don't want to be undertaking the mission, because it's just not something in our society, in an imperfect world where we can't just set fair prices. It's not realistic to try to get started.
Thank you, Mr. Reiner. Do you have a comment? Please identify yourself for the tape, please, as you begin. With a real quick, short comment, I suppose.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Chad Tuohy. I'm the state's compensation manager with the Department of Employee Relations. As part of my role, I'm responsible for managing the local government pay equity program. That program requires all political subdivisions of the state to establish equitable compensation relationships. Equitable compensation relationships are achieved when the compensation for female-dominated classes are not consistently below the compensation for male-dominated classes of comparable work value. With regard to the legislation that's before you, I understand that this bill would seek to implement a similar pay equity process, a reporting and review process, albeit with private sector contractors doing the pay equity reporting. And we have some concerns with that initiative. First, we're concerned that the compensation structures in the private sector may be far more elaborate. Our unfamiliarity and difficult to understand as compared to those commonly found in the public sector. As a result, it may require far more resources to administer the process, or perhaps lead us to have to hire more technically trained, highly skilled staff needed to do the work that we're doing with the local governments. We're also not sure if the private sector compensation scheme will lend itself well to the process, the pay equity reporting process we've already established. Since the merit system was enacted, the linchpin of our compensation has been fairness. Our compensation, meaning government compensation plans, has been fairness. That goal lends itself well with the concept of pay equity. Private sector compensation may not be based primarily on fairness. It could well be based on other business needs or concerns. And I'm just thinking, you know, they have employee stock ownership plans, car allowances, holiday bonuses, retirement benefits. All of these things might be foreign to public sector compensation. And without knowing the systems or processes the private sector relies on to manage their human resources, Dewar is not sure how onerous the pay equity reporting process will be to contractors, nor is it sure, given the effective dates in this bill, if we'll be able to develop a process that seeks input from the private sector to know what to expect. And then finally, depending on how the reporting evolves, it may cause some of the state's current contractors or potential contractors to become frustrated by the certification process or to avoid it altogether and decide not to offer its services for state contract. So for those reasons, the department has strong concerns about the viability of carrying out this policy. And Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Toomey. Any questions? Mr. Zellers, Representative Zellers, excuse me, Representative.
That's all right, Mr. Ward. You can take the S off my name. Just call me Zeller instead of adding the S. Has there been a fiscal note based on your comments on what it's going to increase on your administrative practices? I mean, it sounds like there's a whole cornucopia of things you're going to have to do, but has there been a fiscal note requested? If not,
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers. No, there has not been a fiscal note done for this amendment. There was a fiscal note done on the initial bill, but not for this amendment.
Okay. Just one other question. Chair, under the revocation of contract, and maybe this is for the author of the bill, it authorizes a state agency to terminate the contract. It doesn't say, so is that any, or is that you guys, is that whomever's got the contract with them? It just says in the subdivision 5, the revocation of contract, it authorizes a state agency to terminate a contract. This, I'm looking at the summary, so I don't know if it says it in the bill, but it doesn't. I'm not sure who that would be, if it's you guys or...
Mr. Chairman, that was the part of the bill that was important to admin on that issue. We'll see a fiscal note before tomorrow. I believe that there is one. There was one to the original bill to the Human Rights Department, but I believe that there is one that will see.
And Chair Khan, my question just is, so is it the agency or the department that has the contract with the private, Mr. Shepherd's giving me the idea for the
I do know that you want to move on, Mr. Chairman, so I just move that the bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and I know that we'll have another discussion on Thursday.
That means it's going to be in the bill. That means it's going to be in the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Since Representative Doty is here and he has, and the military is still here, Representative Doty, would you please present your bill?
Madam Chair.
Representative Zellers.
Before Mr. Doty starts, Representative Rukavina's got a bill up today on games of chance or whatnot. If you wanted to take care of that, we heard in Commerce Committee, this is a bill I've carried in the past. This is a private employer performing due diligence, finding out that a video game, because of a rule or administrative function by one inspector, made it illegal or had to do it. So, believe me, it's a very long story, and I won't go into it, but it's a bill we passed out of Commerce, and if you'd like, I don't know, I'll represent Rukavina in the room, but if you want to pass that along, I'll move it and pass it, and then we don't have to bother him.
Representative Rukavina did want this bill going separately, and our motion is that it does go, and there's apparently some discussion about where it needs to go. But the only discussion, Representative Rukavina wants it to go someplace and someone else wants it to go someplace. Fortunately, the only motion we get to make is that it goes to finance. And if you would like to... then whatever fight will occur at another level.
I would move House File 1669 to be moved to the Finance Committee. Pass and move to the Finance Committee, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any discussion about that motion? I think the bill is in our... packet of bills. My immediate question was, why was it before us when, you know, we have a tiny impact on the gambling control bill and a big impact on public safety, and I didn't know why it came here. And so,
if I could even explain why they actually came out with this ruling, Madam Chair, we wouldn't even need this bill.
Oh, okay. Well, in the interest of time, is everyone happy with just moving it to finance? Okay. Okay. All those in favor of Gazelle's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Motion is passed, and the bill goes back to finance. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Conner.
Okay, Mr. Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1134 is necessary because it was recently discovered that the Minnesota National Guard does not have the legal authority to operate this instrumentality, which is essentially a quality of life program that purchases and provides recreational equipment for use by the military. So the only choices that the National Guard Bureau offered the states was to operate as a satellite facility from the nearest military post, in our case that would be Fort McCoy, or to acquire state authority. Colonel Weaver, the Camp Ripley commander, is requesting that we establish this as a state activity for a number of reasons, not the least of which would be that it would be kind of an encumbrance to have federal control over this activity. There is no impact on the state budget. The instrumentality would receive funds from several sources, including a portion of the sales revenue from the post exchange at Camp Ripley, the recycling program at Camp Ripley, and in addition, this bill would allow private donations as gifts from the public, things like that, to be handled through the fund. It would not change the major purpose of this fund. In summary, the two choices, if we don't pass this bill, we would either have to shut down the activity or operate as a satellite facility from Fort McCoy, causing a decrease in the services we provide our members and giving cheeseheads a little authority over the control of our money, neither of which is seen as a good thing. If there are any questions for me or a more expert testifier, we'd be happy to answer those.
Any questions from committee members? Okay, and you do want this in the omnibus, so, or do you want it?
Madam Chair?
Okay.
I'll move that House File 1134 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, and with no objection, we'll do that. And if for any of these bills, if it turns out, as we're putting the omnibus, if there's any reason for them to move forward separately, we can also do that at the same time. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay. Let's go to, oh, we shouldn't have any problems. Representative Bly. The level. We must finish. Representative Block. 2147 is the number.
House File 2147, Madam Chair, is a bill for that I think it is a good government bill and a government efficiency. The idea for this bill was brought to me by my county auditor, and the bill actually I think was drafted by Keith Carlson, who's here and can help me with testifying. It involves a integrated financial system that county auditors can use in accomplishing several of their tasks and duties. And currently, 78 of the 87 counties use this system, and what we're for is a grant that would help in the distribution and upgrade of this system. Currently, Trimane Systems Incorporated is a vendor that's been contracted to do this work, and the counties are doing most of the expenditure to make this happen. Maybe rather than saying anything further, I'll turn it over to Keith, and he can describe anything else that might need to be said.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. One of our members happens to be Rice County, where the gentleman that Representative Bly was referring to is currently acting as county auditor. The integrated financial system is, as Representative Bly indicated, a financial management software that's used by 78 of the state's 87 counties. Right now they are in the process of updating that system. And as a result, they believe that it's propitious to seek dollars to enhance the functionality of that system. To do such things has include improve the tracking and reporting of state and federal grants, provide for electric payments to vendors, provide for the electronic posting of state payments to the financial system, automating revenue collection through check conversion, which basically, for those of you who don't know, is basically the new way of clearing checks instead of actually physically depositing those checks with your bank. You basically take an image and supply that electronically to your bank, and that is used as the means of actually transferring the funds behind those documents, and it is a system that both the private and public sector is rapidly migrating to. It also would provide for automatic clearinghouse transactions, which are electronic funds transfers, and credit card processing, and there's some additional enhancements such as storage or linkage to electronic documents, and increased management and audit control. With that, I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Spiegel.
Madam Chair, Representative, or Mr. Carlson. What again is the role and the responsibility of the state in this integrated system and enhancing that? We're doing our own system and we're enhancing our systems and we're not asking the feds for help. What's the role of the state? What's our responsibility to help you counties with your integrated system?
Madam Chair, Representative Spiegel, the basic issue is that the counties have the wherewithal to do a basic bare bones accounting system right now. They cannot afford to do these additional enhancements that are listed in the bill. To bring them into a more modern sphere in terms of handling their financial management and dealing with the fact that, again, the private as well as the public sector is rapidly migrating to electronic means of doing these financial transactions and for posting them to their financial systems. They believe they need state assistance. Without the state assistance, it's just not going to happen, and they will continue to do their financial transactions and postings by the manual process that, you know, we're all familiar with, paper checks, deposits directly with the banks, with the clearing being provided by the banks. That frankly puts financial pressure on the counties because they have to pay more for those, and indirectly it's going to affect you in terms of higher property tax levies and higher outlays for the various state property tax relief programs. So that's basically the underlying justification for seeking the state's assistance on this.
Mr. Bly.
One other instance would be where the state audits counties, and the idea is that this would make that audit simpler and quicker and save money on both ends in that way.
Okay. I noticed that the grant is to the Chief Information Officer of OET. Have they had any, I don't know if there's anyone here from OET, or do they have any? We do have, okay. Do they have any thoughts about it? And then my next question, Mr. Bly, which you can think about while we're getting this answered, is could you start with less money than this? Here from OET.
Madam Chair, my name is Larry Freund. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Office of Enterprise Technology. This is the first time I've seen this bill here, but this is something that the grants would be distributed from us to the county county's computer cooperative, so it would be us passing on to one entity, which would make it a lot easier. I don't have a process set up right now for grants in the agency, but since we would only be distributing it to one agency, that wouldn't be a big additional burden to us, other than having to do the contracts and do some type of an auditing after the process.
Okay. Any other? Representative Winkle? Do you want him to go away or stay?
He can go away.
Okay.
Let me then pause this. Madam Chair, I have to further disclose here that the company that I work for is under contract with the Minnesota County Computer Cooperative and is in the county IT vendor space. So there is, please understand that. And based on, I guess my question is...
That's my admission of the Starbase board, looks like.
It's nothing. The question is, I see that this is going to the NCCC, as we affectionately call it. Are all counties who are looking to upgrade their financial systems going to participate through the NCCC in purchasing this, or is there some other way to provide these grant dollars so that everybody would be able to make use of them? I know there's often some counties who like to go through this entity, some that don't, and I guess I don't want to necessarily tip the weight too much in one direction if others are interested in going a different direction.
Madam Chair, Representative, in this particular instance, all 78 counties are cooperating under the auspices of MCCC to have done the RFP. As Representative Bly indicated, TriMin is going to be the awardee when they formalize the contract, so all entities that are affected, all 78, would be participating through MCCC.
And Madam Chair, and then what are the other nine counties doing or not doing?
Madam Chair, Representative, the other nine counties are obviously the larger counties in the state, and each of them have their own unique solutions to this issue, and they do not use the integrated financial system for their accounting and financial management tools. Obviously, because of their size, they have some unique means and also have the financial wherewithal to handle it internally or with separate vendors, whereas the 78 are the smaller counties in the state and have banded together to look for the solution.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and I don't know, we've had some discussion in this committee about the concept of value-based enhancements that then kind of return their value. Have you had any kind of discussion about that for this process?
Madam Chair,
count on enhanced, you make the appropriation with the concept that there's going to be an enhanced value coming back that's going to be cost-effective. Do you have any...
Madam Chair, I can't really add anything to my previous testimony. Again, basically, this is facilitating the migration to basically electronic means of doing financial transactions that just frankly does not exist for many of our smaller counties right now, and also to the electronic transactions with their banks. And we believe that clearly provides value. For example, with the check conversion that's noted on line 1.13, you no longer will need to employ a courier service to transmit checks every day to your bank depository. That's clearly a savings. It will be returned to the taxpayer in reduced costs to the county.
Any other questions for either Mr. Carlson or Representative Bly? Okay. If no other questions, then House File 2147 will be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Manager.
And you'll get back to me with a possible reduced appropriation that would work. Okay. Representative Davis.
I'm sorry. I'll talk to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
What's the number? 2252.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move.
Okay. Okay, we got a flurry of papers.
Representative Fortman moves that 2252 be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, members, thank you and good morning. I've got a flurry of papers coming to you now, including an overview of...
Are they all sustainable?
Well, they are if you're part of the timber product industry, which is a renewable resource, Madam Chair. The first, well, I can't say first, one of them, depending on the order you receive them, is an overview of the proposal for a sustainable communities working group trying to have an intentional and thoughtful discussion with a variety of stakeholders around the table about how Minnesota communities across the state can, how we can coordinate state resources to look at more efficiently planning and thinking about the state's role in the global economy, being efficient in our use of tax dollars, thoughtful about our use of energy, and careful custodians of the environment, and coordinating state inputs, whether it's transportation or whatever it might be. The other two documents are both from the League of Minnesota Cities and the Minnesota Association of Small Cities, both stating their support for this proposal. I have with me today Mr. Warren Hansen, President of the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, Madam Chair.
Mr. Hansen.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Warren Hansen. I'm the President of Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. We finance affordable housing in the 80 counties throughout Greater Minnesota. And in the last 10 years, we have also gotten much more interested in sustainable development, land use planning, green building, and assisting communities with technical assistance to help them do more of that type of work. We work very closely with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and the Department of Energy and Economic Development on a range of community development projects, including mixed-use developments and even flood recovery. So we're out there working with the state. For the past 2 years, I've been the chair of a state policy committee convened by the McKnight Foundation that has been looking at comprehensive policy options for improving Minnesota land use decisions, transportation choices, and improving Minnesota's economic prosperity, all while preserving and protecting our environment for future generations. After 2 years of looking at individual policy options and strategies, many with important potential for improving Minnesota's environment and economy, we've become convinced that it's time for a broad base of stakeholders from business, state agencies, the legislature, and philanthropy to be convened to jointly study how to better coordinate the state's already massive investments with an eye toward better aligning these investments across agencies so that wherever possible, state investments work together to intentionally advance sustainability development or sustainable development efforts. The task force would seek to identify a common set of interagency sustainability goals, look for proven strategies for advancing such goals, new metrics for measuring progress, and draw on the best practices from around the country. In the interest of time, I'm going to defer my comments to Eric Mushler at this point, who is here from the McKnight Foundation, and will talk a little bit more detail about philanthropy's interest in this effort.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for having me today. I'm going to back up from the bill.
Say who you are for the tape.
My name is Eric Mushler. I work as the program officer in the Region and Communities Program at the McKnight Foundation. I'm going to back up from the bill for a second and really give you the perspective as a funder. I have some testimony and I can leave copies of it if you wish, but I'm going to go ahead and go through it. I'd like to share some of McKnight Foundation's experience in grant making and a perspective that would inform the deliberation of creating a sustainable growth working group in the state of Minnesota. I only want to make a couple of points today related to the power of coordinating and integrating investments across distinct fields of work that are easily siloed, but never separate when it comes to having the greatest amount of impact on the ground. In communities where citizens live, work, struggle, and have a better life for themselves and their children, the McKnight Foundation's mission is to improve the quality of life and for future and present generations. Through grant making, coalition building, and encouragement of strategic policy reform, we use resources to attend, unite, and empower those we serve. Philanthropy has been and will continue to be complementary to the work of the government. For example, McKnight has invested about $200 million in affordable housing, another $200 million in community development across the state of Minnesota in six regions. McKnight resources are, of course, a tiny fraction of the investments and resource decisions made by the state's agencies annually to address water quality, create transit systems, create workforce housing in local communities in a way that enhances livability. However, by focusing on the resources toward innovation, we do create models that can inform larger systems. For example, the Green Communities Initiative at the Family Housing Fund and the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund is building affordable houses that decrease energy consumption, lower costs for low-income families in housing, and put Minnesota at the forefront of the development of green building practices in the nation. McKnight also provides support for new and innovative public policy research in the areas of planning, transportation, housing, environment, education, and economic development. We have found that the richest ground for innovation is in the cracks between the fields of work, the space between housing and transportation, for example, linkages between environmental conservation and community development. We use the term working across silos to describe our efforts to better integrate and coordinate efforts to maximize impact of our collective efforts, which is at the core of the Regions and Communities program. McKnight itself has purposefully convened scores of organizations, its fundees, and other community leaders frequently over the past 4 or 5 years to share strategies, goals, experiences, mistakes, learnings, to form new working partnerships. This structured communication and collaboration result in innovative strategies and common goals that can be and indeed must be pursued jointly by multiple organizations. This function of identifying shared goals in state government in order to improve outcomes is worth studying and implementing within state government because we all invest in and count on state government to do so much. This policy's approach to fostering innovation and seeking greater coordination of public investments is similar to the work of the McKnight Foundations and other foundations nationally pursuing within their own institutions. That is, the idea of taking interdisciplinary approaches to solving our most challenging community problems. Other states are also beginning to pursue this course, but it's not a strategy that creates more regulation or more bureaucracy. And to the contrary, it's a way to simplify and allow local communities to more effectively use available resources in ways that increase livability and reduce waste. The most effective efforts have been incentive-based criteria established across siloed agencies within state government. I do have a couple more examples, but in the interest of time, I just want to close by saying that Minnesota is facing explosive population growth, climate change, uncertain energy future, growing traffic congestion, worsening air quality, many concerns. Improving how we manage the challenges, identify creative interdisciplinary strategies, and make wise investment decisions holds the promise of being both cost-effective and very productive. Thanks for your time, Senator.
Representative Portman, that's a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding is that the idea behind this legislation grew out of an idea of what Mitt Romney did in the state of Massachusetts. He took the Departments of Transportation, Housing, and Environment and put them all under one head so that their work would be more strategically aligned so that there weren't wasteful investments being made in any of those areas. So I really see this as a way to be more efficient with government investment in infrastructure, and I think that Massachusetts had a really successful experience with that under Governor Romney.
One question about the administrative provision. You have members of the working group serve without compensation. Does that include things like travel expenses and things like that? How are these things done? And I have a possible suggested amendment to that. What's the intention?
Madam Chair, I'm open to suggestions on how that would be interpreted, particularly as it relates to expenses, out-of-pocket expenses for members of the working group. I assume that the assumption was that there would be no per diem available or such alike for members of the working group, since many of the public sector people would be on salary already. But I do think there can be a question asked about out-of-pocket expenses.
Mr. Shepard, is there some better way that can be written, or do we need to? Is there general language that covers?
Madam Chair and members, if the division wanted to have the members of this working group reimbursed for expenses, I'd suggest adding on page 2, line 17, for the period but may be reimbursed for expenses under Minnesota Statute Section 15.059.
Okay, and it's not a requirement, so it would leave it open to the administrators. Okay, I would move that change to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, all those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Motion passes. Okay, any other questions or comments?
Just very quickly, some years ago, and I can't remember the number, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, the legislature passed something called the Community-Based Planning Act. Do you remember that?
The name's long and OPATS.
Yeah.
Ring the bell with that?
And was it also long and OPATS that repealed it the next year or two? Because it was repealed. I remember we passed it, and there was significant concern from counties, cities, property rights groups, and I believe it was repealed. How does this thought, planning, vision differ from that, Madam Chair?
Let's ask the proponent.
Was it 95, 96?
No, but I was warned that I believe that Mr. Shipman has very extensive files on this issue. So we always have to remember that besides you and me and Mr. Shepard, there's another person who was at the table for those discussions.
Madam Chair, Representative Swickham, this bill would not advance a Community-Based Planning Act program or funding for community-based planning. This is really just the intent here is to look at how the state makes investments, how to improve coordination among departments, how to improve the sustainability of those investments, whether they be for housing or transportation or the environment, and just improve overall coordination. Recommendations that may come out of that task force are unknown at this particular point, but it would be a joint public-private working group, and they may have recommendations about how agencies function or perhaps how incentives might be structured.
Mr. Rhodes, anything else? Mr. Rhodes seems to want to say something about this.
Good to see you.
Nice to see you. Just like old times. It is, yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is probably for the author of the bill. Jim Rhodes, Department of Administration, say about that. First of all, the Department of Administration is involved in the bill, so we would kind of like to know who solicits and collects the money. Is this a function for Department of Administration or our group? Or?
Mr. Dabney? Mr. Hansen? Well, Jim, just in the interest of time, why don't you say everything you want to say, and then we'll try and get them answered.
And what the other question is, real quick, if the money is not matched, would the department be still charged with doing the task? And if so, then we'd have to have a fiscal one, I suspect. That's it.
Okay. Mr. Hansen.
Madam Chair and members, we have indications that philanthropy would be interested in providing matching funds for this. And so as members of the nonprofit and philanthropic community, we would arrange for those resources.
Okay. And then I guess, I don't know if there's any clarification that if it seems to me when you say this appropriation is in contingent on a dollar-for-dollar match from non-state sources, mm-hmm. that there is no burden to administration, but we'll
to
clarify
raise the
that.
There would be no burden.
We'll clarify that if it needs to be. Mr. Dabney?
Madam Chair, my understanding is if there's a meaningful state commitment, the philanthropic community is there to match that, but it will require a significant state commitment.
This language in the bill is considered to be a significant state commitment.
Yes.
Okay, any other questions, Mr. Gavin? Okay, then this House File 2252 will be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, which is what I assume you want.
Yes. Thank you very much, okay. Madam Chair and members.
No. Oh, okay. Oh. We'll go. No! Oh. Go ahead. Get out of the way. Yeah, clear on. Okay. Representative Yarros.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, we have a delete all amendment, or should we take it up? Chair and members, the House File 318 started out as an ethnic heritage commission bill to establish ethnic heritage commission. I saw we have four councils: African American, Native American, Asian Pacific, and Latino councils. And I thought that the rest of us should have some kind of a council or commission. So I introduced the bill, and then thinking about...
Does this mean, Mr. Chairman, that you and I and Spigum have to get along?
Well,
just rhetorical question.
Yeah, we do.
We
do.
We should. Gerald Snyder.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members, then I decided not to have a commission because this would involve rules and so on, and establishing another bureaucracy. So I talked to Greg Hebinger from the Legislative Coordinating Commission, in whose office we already have international visitors program that we established about 10 years ago. And he said that he has a part-time person who does that, and he thought for another $38,000 we could add this. About 3-4 weeks ago, Representative Hamilton introduced another commission idea that came to our committee, and I thought it was a good addition, so Greg put the two bills together, and it is called, now the bill is called Minnesota Office on Ethnic Heritage and New Americans. Representative Hamilton's bill dealt with New Americans. So we married the two together. I think they're different genders. So instead of having a commission or a council, it would be just an office within the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and the membership of this office or advisory council would be appointed by the House, the Senate, and the Governor, altogether 14 members. I believe it is four legislators and 10 public members. The assistance, of course, will be provided. The staffing will be provided by the commission, by the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And I, as I said, it was Greg said that it would be $38,000 a year, but he hasn't updated the additional language. I don't know; they might need a little more because we added Representative Hamilton's bill to this bill. And the duties of this office would be to work with community leaders, legislature, and executive branch to develop programs and proposals that will encourage ethnic identity, preserve ethnic heritage, and promote education of the public about the state's heritage and cultural history. Make recommendations to the legislature and governor. Maintain association with ethnic, cultural, minority groups, and community needs, study and consider opportunities and issues of the immigrant community in this state, including steps to eliminate underutilization of immigrants in the state's workforce, improving efficient use of existing state programs, and other appropriate steps to improve the economic and social conditions of immigrants in the state.
Madam Chairman? I'll move the bill if Representative Gerald says we need any more.
Okay. I have become too low balls.
I'll move it to be laid over before I amend to take it out.
Okay, sorry.
Okay. Just one quick question before we can... who are the chairs of the legislative committees and divisions with jurisdiction over affairs affecting it? Ethnic heritage and immigrants?
What do you mean? Let's see. I'm sorry.
I don't know. It's the language in your bill.
Oh, it would probably have to be coming to you because legislative coordinating and commission is
okay.
under you, but it doesn't matter. It
no.
can come to both committees.
Well, I don't think we have jurisdiction.
I did.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair.
This committee has jurisdiction over issues affecting ethnic heritage and immigration.
Oh, okay. Madam Chair, it wasn't my language. It was in Hamilton's, or maybe Greg added it. I did not put that in my bill, but it found itself there.
Okay, well, we'll find out what that is. And the other thing is, for all these things going to the Legislative Commission, I'm also making sure that we add language saying that they'll be assisted by staff from both the House and the Senate. Let's just,
okay.
We'll just manage that,
right.
Add that at some point.
That's a good idea, yeah.
Okay, so if there's no further discussion, House File 318, as amended, to delete everything amendments is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
We have
sorry.
Mr. Winkler, who I think... Oh, I'm sorry.
Pardon me?
Second omnibus bill. What's the second one?
Oh, another bill? Is that? Madam Chair, I thought somebody. Okay. That's the honor guard bill.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Oh yes, that's right. Sir.
Okay. I heard that you already did it, but go ahead. House File 451.
Okay.
Yes.
Madam Chair and members, House File 451 has gone through. Veterans Affairs Division and Ag and Veterans Affairs Policy, and part of it went to was being considered in President Jumpy's Finance Division, and part of it came here because I guess there are two funds. One is for the National Guard, and the other one is for. You have a jurisdiction over
National Guard,
and he and Agriculture and Veterans Affairs have jurisdiction over reservists, I believe. Okay. And this was requested a couple of years ago, but it came late, and I reintroduced it this year, and the idea is to help out the honor guards financially. Wisconsin is doing it. They're giving them a $50 stipend for every funeral that they participate in, that they to honor our veterans. In northeastern Minnesota, they tell me that they had 201 one of those funerals, veterans' funerals, last year, and statewide is I don't remember now, but it's 1,500, I think, or 2,000 or something. All they want, they don't want to be paid for doing this. They just want to cover their expenses, part of their expenses for doing this. And a lot of them are disabled on low income, and you know, they have to drive distances, especially in rural areas. And the bill had a good reception in those committees. We had a couple of emotional discussions. I believe Representative Tingelstedt and Mary Ellen Otremba talked about how much it meant to them when Representative Tingelstedt's dad was buried and Representative Otremba's husband, former legislator, was buried with honor guards present.
Okay. Did anyone? There is this appropriation is going to be done appropriately between the two. We do have the numbers. I think that applies to the National Guard. I think we have those numbers. Will be. And Representative Sigel.
Madam Chair, I was wondering, Representative Jarosz, if you would consider a friendly amendment, and maybe the amendment's not even necessary, but to your bill, I was also made aware of this Wisconsin law. That was, you're correct, Wisconsin has this stipend, this $50 stipend. But as I looked into it, I was kind of given that direction from a couple of veterans groups I have in my own community.
They have the ability to provide this $50 stipend or $25 stipend to young students who may go and play the taps at the you know, the bugle taps at the funeral. And I don't know if your language allows it or not, but Mr. Shepherd does have some language that would allow the VFW or the guard unit to pass on that $50 stipend to the student who would be there to play taps if they chose to do so. Would you be willing? That's kind of what the Wisconsin law allows.
That's fine. That's fine. Yeah, I don't think my bill allows that. I mean, has that provision. But
it doesn't state that the way the Wisconsin law does.
Right. Okay.
Maybe, Mark, would you be willing to, I think you drafted a quick amendment, if Mr. Jarosz would be willing to accept it?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and members, Representative Jarosz, I believe that Representative Swiggum's amendment would go on line 15 after the period, and it would read that if the local unit provides a student to play taps, the local unit may pay some or all of the $50 to the student.
Okay.
Would you be willing? Okay. I think fine. That kind of coordinates with what the
Okay, so with no objection, that will be incorporated into the delete everything.
Okay.
Okay, and also with no objection, House File 318 will be held over for possible inclusion.
Okay, in thank you. Step. Thank you very much.
Okay.
See you.
Okay, thank you. Just generally. We're actually going to finish on time.
I may take a long time.
Oh.
Sure, are we meeting again this afternoon?
I think we're not going to have to. We're going to get the bill turned around, and we're going to try and get it. And then tomorrow was the time we're meeting tomorrow, so we decide. Oh, depends on how quickly we can get the bill turned around. We're going to do for the presentation of the bill and testimony and for comments, and then I think we're going to do formal motions and markup on Thursday, so we can have some committee discussion of the bill tomorrow without amendments, just to see the form, and we'll get it, and we'll get it to you. We'll get it to you guys as soon as we have it. But we may have a little turnaround, and then amendments and the final mark
Friday,
and then finally Friday. You know, if it's confusing enough so that we want to see. Oh well, I think we'd want to anyway. Want to see a full bill, the bill as it's going to look on the floor in front of us. Hopefully, we'll have that on Friday. Okay, Mr. Winston.
Madam Chair, members, I move House File 1896 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The genesis for this idea essentially came from people who've been working in the field of emergency management and preparedness in Minnesota, specifically Jeff Spartz, who is the former CEO of the Hennepin County Medical Center, and Dr. Mike Osterholm of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. They really see the challenge of too many jurisdictions trying to address these issues, from whether they be at the state level, the Department of Health versus the Department of Public Safety sitting in silos. In the metro area alone, there are 260 cities, counties, and townships, not to mention various hospital associations and county emergency management teams who all need to coordinate their work in order to create an effective response and preventative program to disasters, whether man-made or natural. And in fact, I just heard from a constituent outside who has had a 13-year career with the Minnesota Hospitals Association. She happened to see the bill and expressed her strong support for it, and stated that it's very difficult for hospitals to get the active cooperation of county emergency management professionals. So really the concept and the reason to create a legislative commission to deal with this is that we need an entity that looks across agencies, looks across jurisdictions, analyzes risk, and makes recommendations to the legislature for how to allocate limited resources for disaster prevention, and also to provide oversight to the various entities that are tasked with doing this. Not wanting to be charged with too much bureaucratic creep in state government, I've added in the last committee a 4-year sunset provision, but I don't think you have an engrossed version of the bill to address that, or to show that, but that is included in the bill. And the page distributed a letter from Dr. Osterholm talking about some of the specific challenges in a case of a potential disease or flu pandemic, and the fact that whether from the fact that the 9/11 Commission recommendations are only, the final ones are only now making their way through Congress to Hurricane Katrina, the disasters we've seen with FEMA. It's clear that each state is going to need to be responsible primarily for the safety, security of its citizens, and each state is best able to decide what risks and what dangers of disaster that state faces and how to allocate resources effectively. So the concept really is to try to create one entity that can do this, take a look at what we have, make recommendations, provide oversight, and see how we do in improving the fragmentation in 4 years.
Representative Winkler, $1,800,000 is a little high for a commission, even under my tax and spend philosophy.
Madam Chair, I'm prepared to negotiate that amount. The 1.8 is based on a budget that was created for what the best possible scenario would be, understanding, of course, that we have limited resources. I think a great deal of work could be done with a budget that is similar to other types of legislative commissions.
Okay.
And in fact, my understanding is that the University of Minnesota may be willing to work with the legislature providing some of the expertise, space, staff, et cetera, if additional resources are needed.
And I'm also interested in adding the additional language requiring cooperation and use of the legislative staff. One problem that we see, this is an appropriation, but we're sending it to the commissioner, it's a legislative commission, but we're sending it to the commissioner of public safety.
Madam Chair, as we discussed at the Government Operations Committee, the concept started as a public safety concept and it was drafted that way, but I think that the correct place would be to send it to the Legislative Coordinating Commission, so I would consider that to be an appropriate amendment.
Okay, cool. Easy amendment. Okay, no objection to that. Easy amendment. So, anyone have another question from anybody? Representative Sigel.
Madam Chair, it's you and me. Could make for an interesting bill. We have medicinal marijuana.
Not bad.
But after that, I'm going to put it down. In all seriousness,
I'm following in the illustrious tracks of people who have chaired this committee before, like Representative Riccovina, forgetting me, I was so long ago, but Representative Riccovina, Representative Krinke, and Representative Seifert. I assure you, nothing will appear in this bill that any of those four would not have approved.
You and Representative Krinke had a special relationship when it came to putting this bill together. It was one of those bills that when it came to both the House, DFL, and Republican caucuses, we all said, we got to clean it up. Is this, Madam Chair of Citizens, is this Commission 4 or 5? I've been trying new proposed Commission 4 or 5. If you remember, my challenge was to you about a couple weeks ago that we eliminate that commission.
I have one.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I actually have three that Mr. Shepherd has suggested may be possible deletion. So,
oh, good.
And I think maybe a 3-for-1 rule would be.
And then my other question in series is that as we look at this commission, do you know if the majority targets and intent is to fully fund Governor Plenty's initiative for the pandemic, let's not fund that necessary pandemic preparation and preparedness, and then create a commission. Let's make sure that's going to be funded.
Is that in the public safety? Does anyone know
it's
that
in
that
a different area. It's not here, obviously.
Yeah. I think that would be Department of Health.
It's in health, isn't it? Maybe.
Yeah.
It's in health.
Obviously, at
but
some
don't
point.
But not fund that and start a commission. That would be too easy for me on the House floor.
Okay. We'll check. We'll check on that. So that we're at least ready to answer if that's the case.
It would be too easy.
Okay. Okay. Are there any further questions of Representative Wigbrook? Okay. And without further questions, House File 1896 will be the three suggested amendments will be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank you. I think the meeting is adjourned, and we'll get
as much as we can to you tomorrow.